Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday. This hour of the program, he's all over the media today because of the EPA announcement yesterday concerning carbon emissions. Robert Bryce, the optimistic Robert Bryce, is with us. He is the author, most recently, of Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, and Cheaper. He's an acclaimed author of several other books, including Power Hungry, The Myths of Green Energy, and The Real Fuels of the Future. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He has written for many publications, and the book looks at the past. It looks at the fact that, of course, we face challenges, shortages of fresh water, excessive use of pesticides, declining topsoil. The bad news list goes on and on. But he says our future does not lie in the past. We can't solve our problems by foregoing modern energy sources and eschewing modern agriculture for a simpler life based on renewable energy and organic food. We need an ethic that looks at innovation and environmental protection. We need an ethic that embraces innovation and optimism. So he writes about all kinds of things. He looks at technologies that have made us smaller, faster, lighter, denser, and cheaper. He spends quite a bit of time talking about energy. He looks at coal. He looks at nuclear energy. He looks at natural gas. The list goes on and on of what he looks at. It's a fascinating book and essentially is why the human race is in much better shape than it was 200 to 1500 years ago and why he has a sunny view of the future. Maybe you do too. Maybe you don't. Feel free to join us during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and you can reach us on Twitter at K Dunn Show. And we thank you, Robert, very much for being with us. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. You've had a busy day. I heard you this morning on Point talking about energy.
There's plenty to talk about these days. Well, there's always lots to talk about. I mean, this is the world's biggest industry. It's the world's most important sector, and people have passionate feelings about it. A lot of people think they understand it, and there's a lot of issues to understand. So, yes, today has been busy.
I'll bet it has. Yeah, well, thanks so much. Your book is so optimistic, and it makes me realize that a lot of what we report on, a lot of the things that we talk about, are not very optimistic, really. The book, you say, is a rejoinder to the doomsayers, that there are a lot of people who are telling us now that disaster is around every corner. Is disaster not around every corner? Are they doing that for some other reason, or what?
You know, that's a good point, Kathleen. Yeah, sure. And this is one of the things, as I started to do my research and do some writing and think about this, that yes, I mean, you know, we have always faced problems throughout our history on this planet. That from when we first started, you know, walking upright, people were wondering, well, where am I going to get my next meal? Where am I going to, you know, how am I going to feed my kids? You know, I've had these same worries as a parent. You know, how am I going to make it? But we always seem to, you know, blunder our way through, sometimes intelligently, sometimes not so. But to just complete that point, as I looked at this idea about return, you know, oh, we've ruined the earth, we need to go back to nature. This myth really goes back to the Garden of Eden. And then you look at the ideas that were put forth by Rousseau, and then Thoreau, and then through Rachel Carson to Edward Abbey, to even Bill McKibben and Naomi Klein today. It's all, in my view, kind of a piece about that we've done too much, we have too much technology, we need to go backward. And, you know, as you point out in your introduction, the opposite is true. We have to believe in technology, and we need optimism going forward.
Mm-hmm. Every year you write in your book, which is really incredible, people on this planet spend $5 trillion on energy. That's a huge amount of money. Let's look at energy for a while here, because obviously we had the announcement from the EPA, carbon emissions, that took place yesterday. We do hear, and we do see terrible stories of people not being able to breathe in China because the air is so bad, the same in L.A., the same in heavily polluted places. Does that not mean that maybe we need to look at an alternative to the kind of energy that we're using now? Will we come up with something brand new?
There's no question, and I have looked at China and a lot of other people have, and wondered, okay, how are they going to go forward? And it's one reason why, just as a very quick side note, why I'm so optimistic about the United States. We have all kinds of energy sources here that we can switch to. It's one of the reasons that the Obama administration was able to make this move with the EPA, saying we're going to reduce our coal burn because we have plenty of shale gas. Well, for China, that's really not an option now. Mm. They don't have the infrastructure. They don't have the drilling sector that we do. They don't have the pipelines that can handle gas, but they do have coal. And this is one of the reasons why everyone says, oh, we have to contend with the Chinese and so on. The rise of China isn't concerning. It is in some regards, but their environmental problems that they're having because of their excessive coal use, they're really enormous. Mm-hmm. Look, there is no such thing as a free lunch anywhere, but it's particularly true when it comes to the energy sector. So every part of our use of energy involves some costs. And yes, coal exacts a big cost, but, people are also complaining about hydraulic fracturing. They complain about wind turbines being near their homes. Again, there's no free lunch.
Right. Well, is there something that's about to be developed that's going to be perfectly clean and very inexpensive and will solve all that ails us?
Boy, Kathleen, if I knew that, I wouldn't be telling you. I'd be buying shares in the company.
Yeah, so would I.
I'd be richer than Warren Buffett and Bill Gates together. I'm adamantly pro-nuclear. I'm very hopeful for nuclear. There's no question that nuclear energy is a difficult issue for a lot of people to understand because it is complicated. It's not just like burning gasoline in your car. Harnessing the atom comes with a whole lot of issues, including governmental intervention, government management of the waste, international issues where we need some international police to effectively look at the industry and police the industry. The International Atomic Energy Agency is that entity. But if you look even in the wake of Fukushima at how nuclear has progressed, I'm very optimistic because of the venture capital money that's flowing into the nuclear sector, because of the new safer, passive safe designs that are coming out. I mean, I think if there is a wonder energy source, it is clearly nuclear.
Mm. But where do you put Fukushima in all of that? The memory of it, the experience of it.
Well, and this is difficult because people think Fukushima, oh, thousands died. Well, thousands did die, but they died from the effects of the earthquake and the tsunami. Only two people died directly as a result of the nuclear plants. There were two workers who drowned inside the plant. Now, I'm not here to minimize the results or the cost of the cleanup at Fukushima, which is ongoing. It's going to be incredibly expensive. Mm-hmm. No question about it. But those sites, those plants were poorly sited, and they were poorly designed. They didn't have the passive safe cooling systems. But all of that said, if we're going to be serious about CO2 emissions and climate issues, nuclear has to be a major part of the issue, or I'm sorry, major part of the answer. And I think that for countries, particularly in Asia and in Western Europe, where they don't have access to a lot of low-cost natural gas and where their ability to use coal is somewhat constrained, then nuclear already makes sense for them regardless of the CO2.
Mm-hmm. So what about the idea that we have reached a point where whatever we're using that isn't very good, things like coal, are going to do us in eventually, maybe not tomorrow, but hundreds of years from now. And what's happened is that everybody's emulated a model that's more part of Western countries, and particularly the United States, that's a luxurious model, that you should own a lot, you should have a couple cars, you should live in a nice house, you should buy a lot of consumer goods. As you well know, there have been people who have said the end is near when it comes to that. We just can't live that way anymore. Everybody is emulating an unsustainable model.
And again, I go back to kind of where we started, Kathleen, which is what we heard from Thomas Malthus in the 1780s. So there's not enough food to go around. We're gonna starve. Paul Ehrlich said the same thing in 1968 with the population bomb. He said in the 1970s, there's no way that we can avoid this. Tens of millions of people will starve to death.
Mm-hmm.
We've heard this over and over, that we just simply don't have our capability to innovate. And if you look at industrial commodities, and I have a couple of graphics, or one or two graphics in the book, where I look at the price of industrial commodities, including steel and copper and so many others, that over time they've in fact fallen in price. instead of going up, which is counterintuitive, of course. But to get back to your other point that you're, I think you're making, was here we are in the United States, and I live a very comfortable life. I mean, incredibly so. I mean, it's sometimes, and my son, he's 18 the other day, and he said, "Man, I'm just amazed at how nice our stuff is." he went to Bolivia, and he lived in Bolivia for 3 months, and he lived in a home that didn't have air conditioning, where he was sleeping on the floor, and he realized, you know, this is really incredible.
Yeah.
I guess it is incredible, and I'm for more energy for everyone, because more energy, more low cost energy for everyone, that's the foundation of modern society. So, you know, I'm not about to say this isn't sustainable. I'm saying if these people have the capability, if their society is capable of providing these kinds of goods, then more power to them.
Yeah. Let's go to technology for a moment. You talk about the smartphone, and every time I think about it, every day that I use that thing, I just got one a few months ago, and it just does everything. And then I realized, and you confirmed, that there was more sophistication, technological sophistication in that smartphone than there was in what it took to get people to go to the moon. Ain't that something? I mean, it was really hard to get people to go to the moon.
That's no mean feat, but yes, I did the. It's simple calculations. I wasn't a math major, but I can use a calculator. I use a smartphone. It that little device that I carry in my pocket that's now smaller than a pack of cigarettes.
Yeah.
Has 250,000 times more digital storage capacity than the computer that went to the moon on board Apollo 11.
Amazing. So, what does all that do? What does it do for us? What does that mean?
It does everything, but for me, it does everything but bake my bread. I mean, it's remarkable. You get email on it. I flew on an airplane, a small plane, a while ago, and the pilot filed his flight plan on his iPhone.
Wow.
I mean, the capabilities that we carry in our pockets now are staggering, and of course we take them for granted because, oh, well, of course we have one. You know, of course we can look up our street maps on our phone. Of course we can send a text to people halfway around the world and it's free, or we can talk to them for free, or, you know, any number of things. You know, sports scores. I follow the NBA. I can get instantly, you know, sports scores that I would have to either turn on the television or I'd have to wait for the next day's newspaper.
Yeah, how true. So what has it done for our development as human beings? Has it made us more compassionate? Has it made us more innovative? What has it done in that regard?
Well, as a parent, it's kind of irritating because I'm looking at their kids.
At their phone,
you know,
yeah.
Well, I'm right here. Why aren't you talking? Oh, well, I'm texting so-and-so. Well, you know,
I know.
Maybe we could talk.
I know.
But I think at the same time, what has it enabled? We have now 7 billion people on the planet, and we have, what is it, the latest numbers, was it 5 or 6 billion smartphones?
Goodness.
When in human history have we had a time where, in effect, anyone can call nearly anyone? I mean, we've had this incredible leveling of the communication systems, which I think is incredibly powerful. Think about a century ago, where we were in terms of communications. And what happened? What prevailed a century ago? Well, of course, gender bias, racism, you know, sexual preference bias. Today, women have the right to vote in nearly every country in the world. And why is that? I think it's because of mass communications. The, you know, people in other countries seeing, you know, women with jobs, women working, women doing whatever. All of this, I think, is one of the outgrowths of this ability now where we have cheap, super cheap, or even free communications. We have this ability now to see and understand cultures all the way around the world thanks to the Internet. We have all of these things that are allowing us incredible capabilities that our great-grandparents could have only dreamed about.
Yeah, it is amazing, isn't it? I think about that every now and then. You must as well, more than most of us, think about all that's been developed since our grandparents' time on this earth, and all that was developed in my time on earth as well. You know, this whole computer thing, it's changed absolutely everything.
Sure. And the ability to retrieve, I quote, there was one, that we've seen the Arab Spring and all the things that have come about from that, and clearly not all of those results have been positive. Look at the upheaval in Syria. Look at the upheaval in Libya. But at the same time, look at how these societies where they try to restrict the flow of information. I have one chapter in the book where I say the faster the bits, the freer the people.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the faster information is allowed to move, you can pretty much correlate the countries where information is allowed to flow freely are generally the ones that are free or freer. And they're also the ones that tend to be wealthier. And where are the countries where they try to restrict the flow of information, where they try to slow the bits? Cuba, Iran, China. Repressive regimes that are generally have economies that are nowhere near the levels of the economies in the developed world.
And yet, go
ahead.
And yet, I've heard from a number of technology experts that the speed could be a lot faster in the United States too. We're nowhere near, say, Japan.
Absolutely, or South Korea.
Right.
And I see no reason why we shouldn't be. And it's one of the things that is aggravating. Why don't I have? Look, we're a much wealthier country than South Korea. We invented this stuff, and yet our access speeds are slower. It makes no sense to me.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, let's go to phone calls. We have many of them coming in. Robert Bryce is our guest this hour. His latest book is Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, and Cheaper. And he looks at a number of issues, a lot of the book, and it seems most appropriate today because we're on the heels of the big energy announcement by the EPA yesterday. He has a whole chapter in the book that looks extensively at the energy sector, how much money we spend on energy, that we need to embrace a certain kind of energy. N2N is what he talks about. We'll talk more about that. Natural gas, nuclear, he believes in both of those very strongly, or if there, we have yet to find out if there's something else on the horizon that nobody would worry about because it would be a really good thing. He says the energy sector is by far the world's biggest industry, and every sector of the global economy depends directly or indirectly on it. We need, he believes, more natural gas, more nuclear energy, more oil and solar energy, and yes, more coal. He looks historically at the push for smaller, faster, lighter, denser, cheaper in places like Ford and Intel. He looks at ideas on how we can continue fostering innovation regardless of what our beliefs are about issues politically, what are the best no-regrets policies for the future. And he's optimistic. You can hear it in his voice. Do you share his optimism that we're going to make it through all of this? Okay. Maybe you're not as optimistic, and you can tell us why. Here's how you reach us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And you can also find us on Twitter @KDunnShow. Robert is author of many books. He is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and has written for all kinds of publications. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to your phone calls for Robert Bryce, author of Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper. And we start our calls with Bob in Milwaukee. Hello, Bob.
Hello.
Hi, Bob.
Hi, how you doing?
All right.
Hey, more of a comment, really, than a question. First, I guess, my general premise is that I come from a biological perspective, and firstly, my take on life so far for the last 45 years has been that we're basically monkeys with BMWs or maybe cell phones now. I mean, we're just primates that have a little bit more intelligence but not quite enough to figure things out. Every time we solve something, we create three more problems, and it ain't that great because I suppose that creates more jobs. Secondly, the unmitigated growth is a biological principle, and in biology it's known as cancer. So that's the basic problem to all of our other issues, is we got too many monkeys with BMWs. Thirdly, about 40 years ago, I wrote my first term paper. It was on nuclear waste disposal. At that time, the research that I did, which was fairly extensive, indicated that the corporate line and the line in the media was, don't worry about this nuclear waste problem. We're going to fix it in the future. The technology will evolve. The technology will improve. And it's not really a problem. 40, 50 years later, I'm hearing exactly the same line. I don't buy it. I don't think anybody should. It's a problem that's not going to go away, and we're going to have to deal with for the better part of the next 60,000 years. That's the half-life of any of these materials.
Mm-hmm. What about that? Is it a significant concern, Robert?
Look, we hear over and over about nuclear waste, and this is the bugaboo. We can't solve the problem. Let's look at France. here's a country that gets nearly 80% of its electricity from nuclear. And in France, they manage all of their high-level waste, and they put it in one location in Le Hague, in a on a facility in one building that's the size of a soccer pitch. If the French can handle their nuclear waste, the United States can handle its nuclear waste. This isn't a technical problem; it's a political problem. Every energy source has a downside. There's no question about it. But if we're going to be serious about carbon dioxide and climate change, nuclear has to be part of the answer. Now, if you don't believe in climate change, that's your deal. You go ahead. But this idea of too many monkeys and BMWs, you know, it's the same story we heard from Malthus. Are there too many of us? Same thing we heard from Paul Ehrlich in 1968, and he still claims it today. We have twice as many people today on the planet as we did when Ehrlich made his pronouncements back in the late 60s and early 70s. We've heard all these arguments about, oh, we have too many people. Well, I'm just not willing to say that. I'm a humanist. I believe, you know, if people want to have babies, I think that's fine. And if they want to have more babies, they want to have five, they want to have 10, that's their deal. I'm not having the government step in and say, I'm sorry that we have too many of us. Look at what's happened in China. Look at the absolute outrageous cruelty in China from the one-child policy, or even worse, North Korea. I mean, it's a totalitarian state. I'm for more people. I'm for more freedom. I'm for economic growth and liberty, and I'm just not apologetic about any of it.
Thanks very much for the call. I'm for fewer people who don't have anything, and I'd like to look at the issue because there may be a lot of people on Earth, but there are also over a billion people. We did this interview a couple months ago with photos of people in the world, all over the world, who live on a dollar a day or less. And those images, Robert, have just stayed with me, that life is so incredibly hard for a lot of people. It seems to me as though some of this optimism that you have and some of this belief, you know, in all our technology in reaching every corner of the earth doesn't seem to be doing that, that there are a lot of people who are having a hard time getting by, and they are dying because they don't have enough to eat, and they are dying because they're exposed to chemicals that are harmful to them. And it's a huge part of the world's population. What are we doing about those people?
You make a great point, Kathleen, and I'm not going to argue that point. There, we do have incredibly high numbers of people who are living in dire poverty. In India alone, there are 400 million people. In India alone, there are 400 million people that don't have access to electricity. I cannot imagine my life without electricity. Right. We live in incredible energy abundance.
Mm-hmm.
But my response is, okay, well, yes, we've always had poor people. We're always going to have poor people. But let's look at the trends. And I have a graphic in the book showing how since the 1970s, the number of people who are living in dire poverty has declined. We've seen significant increases in income levels for the poorest of the poor. We've seen also at the same time incredible increases in literacy rates. In the 1950s, roughly 56% of all adults were literate. Today, the number is close to 90%. So there's no question. This grinding poverty, I mean, I've seen it myself in traveling the world, and it's heart-wrenching.
Yeah.
But how do we solve that? I think we have to trust in technology, but moreover, we have to figure out how do we get the poor access to more modern energy sources. That's the key to getting them out of poverty in almost every case. Why are they poor? Because they don't have the tools, the essential commodities that allow them to improve their living standards. And in some cases, that may be as simple as a solar panel and a battery and an LED light.
Yeah. Willem in Colfax, hi.
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 Earlier he said something about the price of steel and all that sort of stuff. I think maybe some of that has to do with the decline of unions and wages in general, which have seen a 30-year decline. But that wasn't my point. My point is that I've seen a lot of advertising on television. This lady comes on, little hummingbirds and butterflies, and talks about the safe, clean gas revolution and how this proven safe technology of fracking. But what isn't mentioned is that in this process, we are removing thousands of acres and millions of tons of sand from Wisconsin and affecting communities where people live, creating zones where property values drop by 30%, increased truck traffic, threats to our water from undisclosed chemicals that they don't have to tell the public what it is because of laws that have been passed. In our state, a law is being tried to be passed by Senator Tom Tiffany, and I heard it was going to be maybe put in the budget so it could be even more stealth. That would take away local control from people to regulate this industry. And we don't tax it. We don't get an extraction fee like Texas and Alaska does. We get nothing, and except for destruction of habitat, thousands of birds and animals and deer and all these other living creatures that whose habitat we destroy, all for this clean, proven, safe technology. It's just a myth.
All right, let's talk about fracking. Robert, your thoughts on it?
Well, I'll address the sand issue first. It is, I don't know what why it is that Wisconsin seems to be the epicenter of America's sand supply and sand deposits, but it is the case. And so a lot of the fracturing operations in the United States depend on sand coming from Wisconsin. And I've read about and heard about the friction that is causing among with neighbors in Wisconsin. I have nothing that I can say that will make any of that go away. As I said earlier, and we'll say many, many more times, energy extraction of any kind exacts a cost. And for the people that have fence line issues from the sand operations, and it is mining from the truck traffic, from the railroads, from all of the different things that are happening in Wisconsin because of this desperate need for frack sand in the industry, I understand it. And I understand why people are angry and how their property values have been impacted. But the caller also said, all the undisclosed chemicals and, that this is implying that somehow this is an industry that is out of control. The EPA's own, if you look at not the current, not Gina McCarthy, the previous head of the EPA testified before Congress that she didn't know of any cases where groundwater had been contaminated because of hydraulic fracturing. Now, I've been in the oil field. I've seen it. I've been on fracturing operations. I've been on drill rigs. I understand this extraction has a price tag, and there are fence line issues that are significant from just some of those same issues, truck traffic, noise, dust, vibration. All of these things are fence line issues that as the industry expands, we have the same kind of conflict. But I've also talked to people in Wisconsin who've had the same kinds of conflicts due to wind turbines. I have a man named Ron Enns. I'm trying to remember his name. He lives in Denmark, Wisconsin. He and his wife had 9 wind turbines put up within a few hundred meters of their home. They're now living in an RV because of the noise produced by those wind turbines. I mean, look, as I said before, every energy source has a cost, and I'm not a big advocate of the wind industry because of this displacement and the massive amounts of land that's required. So I take the caller's points, but again, this is not unique to the oil and gas extraction industry either.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about his point that you talked about there hadn't been a known case of contamination? We did a show, you probably are aware of Showtime doing this long thing on natural gas and on global warming, a huge, long series, and we talked with the people who are putting that together. They were looking at natural gas, and everybody's espousing natural gas, and yet from the studies, and these aren't fly-by-night people, they're serious scientists who've been looking at some of these wells and the amount of leakage that's taking place at those places in Colorado and in California, and just natural gas leaks from the ground in cities all over this country because they're not sealed very well, and how it really is adding to carbon dioxide emissions and a big source of the problem. If you're a believer in global warming, a lot of it is caused by this. So my question to you is, sometimes we worry that they haven't done the proper kinds of studies, be it on fracking or being on natural gas extraction, to make us be cautious with our exploration of that kind of energy, that by golly, if we're going to do it, we better full well know what the cost of it might be, don't you think?
You raise a good point, Kathleen, and I'll just offer a couple of quick responses. One is, the U.S. now is drilling something on the order of 40,000 oil and gas wells a year. That's
probably
been about the number. And over the last, more than 40 years or so, their hydraulic fracturing has been used on over 1 million wells in the United States.
Hmm.
Now, has there been water contamination from oil and gas extraction? There is no question about it, and I've written about it myself many times in Texas Monthly and in other places. and I've seen some of the destruction the oil and gas industry has had on wildlife and on rural areas. There's simply no question. But at the same time, modern society depends on cheap, abundant, reliable energy. And the United States is now, because of the shale gas revolution, is producing more natural gas than any other country in the world. And that industry is now saving the U.S. economy something on the order of $200 million a day in reduced costs for natural gas relative to the prevailing price of natural gas back in between 2000 and 2008. The U.S. now has a price advantage on natural gas second to no other country in the world except maybe Qatar. And that advantage is now particularly important given Russia's invasion of Crimea. The Europeans are behind the eight ball when it comes to natural gas. So I've said it before, I'll say it again. Every energy extraction method takes a toll, and the oil and gas industry takes a toll. There's simply no question.
Yeah. All right, let's go. Thanks very much, Willem, for your call. Ralph and Little Swanico. Hi, Ralph.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I heard your guest this morning on Point, and I'm thankful to have a chance to talk to him again. I think he offers a very balanced point of view. And, you know, this is maybe a little bit off topic, but, you know, one of the examples of something that always seems to be a doom and gloom kind of thing is global warming. And there are definite bad things about global warming, but there are also good things. And it seems like nobody ever mentions the good things. You know, like improved shipping lanes, better access for fishing, more plant growth, which by itself uses up CO2, longer growing season. You know, these things don't ever seem to come up. It's always like, oh, it's going to be terrible. It's the end of the world. And I think we got to balance this. There's good and bad and everything.
I think you raise a good point, and I, you know, my book, the subtitle of my book is How Innovation Keeps Proving the Catastrophes Wrong. And when it comes to climate, we are really inundated with the message from the climate catastrophes that we're all going to, you know, the cartoonish kind of image, I guess, maybe we're all going to burn in hell right here on Earth. And look, I'm a climate agnostic. Tell me CO2 is good. Tell me it's bad. I'm so bored with the tribalism and the nastiness of the tribalism. Tell me what your answer is. And that's why I'm a proponent of natural gas and nuclear. Regardless of whether you think CO2 is good or bad, natural gas and nuclear offer a lot of advantages in terms of cleaner air, in terms of smaller footprints, all of the things that we should be wanting. So I take your points, but I hesitate to go into the climate change debate too far because it's a briar patch, and just that you get labeled, oh, you're a denier, you're a catastrophist, you work for Sierra Club, you work for the big oil or whatever. I mean, it's become so nasty and so vituperative that it's been difficult to have any kind of a conversation about the issue at all.
Hmm. Well, it is one of those issues, though. Let's spend some time on climate change, if you don't mind. It is one of those issues. That I don't know if you'd call them catastrophists or what, but a lot of scientists in the world are saying that this is the issue of our times. That this is not only alarmist, this is just something that we have to pay attention to, and it will significantly alter our planet and the makeup of the plants and the people who live on this planet and the cities, you know, that dot all the coasts, etc. Would you agree that no matter what, and we may debate this, whether it's nuclear or whatever source we go to, but that we need to address this issue, which is all important. Energy, how we get energy, will be a big part of determining whether or not we're able to survive. Do you believe that's a valid thing, a valid question?
Well, look, this is an incredibly difficult issue. There's simply no question. I found it's Dave Enns. And if you just Google Dave Enns, E-N-Z, he's a gentleman in Denmark, Wisconsin, who has the wind turbine.
The wind thing, yeah.
His home.
Okay.
Right. But let's examine that issue, Kathleen, because if we go forward and we're going to accept the idea that the climate is getting more extreme in any direction, whether it's going to be hotter in some locations, colder, we have colder extremes in other locations, what's the inevitable result of that? We're going to have to produce a lot more energy in order to deal with those extremes. So I understand and I've read many of the reports. I've looked at the latest IPCC report. I understand the claims, and I guess to me, we can talk about those claims all day and all night. Mike, the thing that I say in the book, in Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper, is I'm bored with talking about climate models. I want to talk more about engine models, nuclear reactor models, fuel cell models.
Mm-hmm.
How are we going to more effectively turn the energy we have into the power that we need? That's the challenge, whether we're going to use more solar panels or nuclear or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
How are we going to harness the energy that we need and more effectively convert it into motive power, into cooking power, computing power, the things that allow our economy to continue moving?
Mm. Thanks, Ralph, for your call. Liz in Delavan. Hello.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to comment that the Dakotas use apparently a lot of coal for their energy supplies. And they do not have very much pollution at all because their scrubbers they use on their plants take about most of it, 90% or more, out of the air. And I'd like a comment on that. Thank you. I'll just get off the air.
All right, Liz. Thanks.
You know, that's an interesting point that the caller makes, that Liz makes, because one of the odd outgrowths of the efforts to reduce acid rain in the East Coast, in the eastern U.S., and it was an important issue, no question about it. And it was one of the cases where governmental regulation stepped in and said, we need cap and trade, and it worked magically. Well, so these coal-fired power plants did, as the caller said, and put scrubbers on their plants. What did that allow? It allowed the use of more high-sulfur coal. It allowed miners in what's called the Illinois Basin, southern Kentucky, and elsewhere to mine more effectively, mine more coal that could be used in power plants that now had scrubbers on them. So it didn't result in less coal being used, but it allowed a combustion of the coal to be cleaner. But I think that the point that she makes is an interesting one. I'll just add one quick point about the Dakotas. It's just fascinating to see what's happened in North Dakota, where in 2005, North Dakota's oil production was about 90,000 barrels a day. Today, it's over 900,000 barrels a day.
Mm.
But they're wasting tremendous amounts of resources because they're flaring the natural gas, which I think is a real problem, because not only just because of the CO2, but they're wasting a valuable resource. And it's taken a while to address that, but I think it's slowly being addressed.
More phone calls in just one moment. Our guest this hour is the author of Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper. Robert Bryce is with us, and we're covering a lot of territory. Obviously, energy is a big part of what we're discussing. He's a senior fellow with the Center for Energy Policy and the Environment at the Manhattan Institute. His other books include, I should give you the subtitle too. So the book is Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper, How Innovation Keeps Proving the Catastrophists Wrong. He's been writing about energy for a long time now, and he's also author, you may have read some of these books, Power Hungry, The Myths of Green Energy, and The Real Fuels of the Future. Here's how you reach our conversation. I want to move into cars for a moment, and obviously we all drive our cars and we drive airplanes as well. What are we seeing? He has a chapter on Ford. What are we seeing in terms of car makers around the world addressing our energy needs and designing things that will be cars of the future? What might those be? We can talk about that. We can talk about a lot of things. So just call. Here's our number again, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter @KDunnShow. Our lines are open. Are you as optimistic as Robert is about our future? If you look at where we've been, we've made it thus far, and we are being partially because we're a nation of headlines and we take short headlines and that's what our news is, and bad news sells, so that it's become incredibly alarmist and maybe too much so. All right. Well, we welcome more of your calls. We'll take them in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right. Let's go back to phone calls. Wally in Jackson County is next. Hey, Wally.
Yes.
Hi.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I haven't heard anything mentioned about energy conservation, which I think is our biggest problem. We are wasting far too much energy. There are probably several hundred Amish farms in west central Wisconsin, and they all live just fine without any natural gas, without any electricity, without any automobiles. Why can't the rest of us do something more like that?
Well, it'd be a whole different way of life. Most of us wouldn't do that, don't you think, Wally?
Yes, I think we could all go a little more that way.
Oh, but I...
Not...
Okay. It conserve more.
And Wally, are you Amish? Do you live on an Amish farm?
Wally, are you... Huh. Wally? Wally's gone.
I just had a quick comment on that, Kathleen. Everyone else wastes energy. I use the right amount every time. I understand the arguments about efficiency. We've become dramatically more efficient in everything that uses energy, from our computers to our light bulbs to our cars. In the 1970s, we were using about the same amount of oil as we are today, 18, 19 million barrels of oil per day. We have twice as many cars today, and we're driving them more than twice as many miles. What happened? We got more efficient in the way we use oil and gasoline and diesel fuel. I hear this over and over, we're wasting energy. Well, I don't think I waste energy. But then again, I don't have the optimum number of shoes in my closet or the optimum number of shirts. I bought the car that I bought because it was the one that made sense to me. It was big enough for my family. It had to look nice. I didn't think about how fuel efficient it is. It was one of the factors, but it wasn't the only one.
Well, let's talk about cars for a moment. You talk about Ford in the book, and when you think about cars, you think about the title of your book in some ways. They are lighter, they are smaller, they are faster, they are more efficient. I wonder, when you think about what we're going to be driving, or maybe we'll just have these little packs on our back and we'll finally fly around like I thought we were going 2 years ago, but what do you see? What will happen with transportation?
It is a remarkable story. I published a piece, it was in the Chicago Sun-Times and the Detroit News a few days ago, about Alan Mulally's tenure at Ford. And it's one of the most remarkable turnarounds in modern American industrial history, how he took the company, almost on the verge of bankruptcy. What did he do? He pursued the same things that Henry Ford did, which was smaller, faster, lighter, denser, cheaper. Mm. One of the things that I wrote about in the Chicago Sun-Times piece, and I write about it in the book as well, is the EcoBoost engine. And we hear all about hybridization and the Prius and so on, and those are remarkable technologies for automobiles, and they're going to continue to mature and be used. But what we've seen with the 1-liter, 3-cylinder EcoBoost engine that Ford is now marketing and is starting to sell in the United States, they're selling them by the hundreds of thousands in Europe already, is this incredible increase in power density. This 1-liter engine produces 92,000 watts per liter. It's 123 horsepower out of an engine that the footprint of it is about the size of a sheet of ordinary office paper.
Oh.
I mean, it's incredibly compact and incredibly power dense. The power density of that engine is roughly the same as that of the engine in the Bugatti Veyron, a car that cost $1.2 million.
Whoa. Wow.
But and you look back, compared to the engine that was in the original Model T, it's 16 times as power dense and as 3 times as fuel efficient.
Mm.
I mean, it's just an incredible achievement. So
yeah.
I think that the transportation of the future, the cars of the future, are going to look a lot like the cars of today. They're going to have internal combustion engines.
Mm. Do you think we're going to fly?
Flying cars?
No, flying us with those little things on our back.
Oh, with jetpacks?
Yeah,
or
something like that.
Wouldn't that be awesome?
I'd love to. Yeah, I know. I think about that a lot. I just thought we had it by now.
I think that would be so great. I'd like to go into space. I'd like to ride on one of those spaceships and go into low Earth orbit. I think that would just be fantastic.
Well, go ahead. You go ahead and do it. I'd be scared silly. Let's go to Ann in Madison next. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Well, speaking of smaller, I don't understand why we shouldn't go back to more local production of energy so that people have the ability to talk to local, service representatives, and you don't have huge transmission lines like ATCs all over the Midwest, maybe all over the country, just carrying energy from one spot to maybe another spot 2,000 miles away. And when something breaks down in these systems, then the whole system breaks down. And I honestly think that we should go back to, you know, not totally a village economy where everything is somewhat in the same circle, but, you know, do it on a much smaller scale. And if you have, like, 400 windmills, high-powered turbines, you know, right next to your house, it's going to be unbearable. But if you have a few that are located, you know, a sensible distance from houses, then people will, you know, will accept that kind of clean energy. And probably the same with solar energy. You know, nobody wants to be surrounded by an industrial complex of any kind.
Robert.
Sure. The power line issue and these pylons, this is an issue all over the world that people are resisting. And it was in Dublin just a few weeks ago. There were more than 2,000 people marched against the construction of high voltage pylons in Ireland, and they're also objecting to the installation of hundreds of wind turbines being installed in the Midlands in Ireland that would then carry that electricity down to London and to the southern England. So this is an issue that's happening all over the world, and the resistance to it is incredible. The resistance in Wisconsin alone is remarkable. Of course, the so-called green representatives and the green people supporting wind energy are saying, oh, well, you know, these are just a bunch of complainers. No. This backlash against the wind industry is widespread, and it's growing. Now, to the points that the caller made, I understand the sentiment, but I don't necessarily want an oil well in my backyard. Now, I do have solar panels on the roof of my house, and I'm bullish on solar. See the cost of solar coming down dramatically? I think that the trend that we're already seeing in the utility business is toward more distributed generation and solar low-cost solar panels on roofs is going to be a part of that. Is that disrupting the utility business? Yeah, it is, and it's going to be a painful transition.
Thank you, Ann, so much. Let's go to Pat in Onalaska. Hi, Pat.
Hello. I wonder if Mr. Bryce is able to take a hint from France and use nuclear fusion instead of fission, theoretically.
Huh. Well, that's a good question. Fusion has not been commercially proven on any kind of scale anywhere on the planet. It is still the ideas behind fusion are still largely theoretical. We haven't developed any reactors that use fusion on any kind of scale. France uses fission reactors. So I've heard about fusion, and fusion has always been kind of like electric cars, the next big thing, and it always will be.
Hmm. Is there anything else that's the next big thing, Robert?
Well, and one of the most interesting companies, I think, in the book, you know, I talk about Ford, as you pointed out, Intel, Clean Energy Systems, Safaricom, which is a company in Kenya that does mobile payments. But I think on the energy front, it's clearly the issue of electricity storage, and that's the company I profile in the book is Aquion Energy, and they're a battery company. They were spun out of Carnegie Mellon, or the guy who came up with the design is a guy named Jay Whitaker, a very clever guy who was at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh, and now they're scaling up their factory outside of Pittsburgh to build large-scale grid storage batteries. And that could make a huge difference. But the deployment is going to be very slow, mm-hmm. and the number of batteries needed to store and the size of the batteries needed to store significant quantities of electricity, it's remarkably large.
Hmm. Well, thank you ever so much for being with us. You can hear.
It's been great, Kathleen. It was really a pleasure. I've done a bunch of interviews, and this was maybe the best, most fun I've had.
Really? And you're a guy who has fun, I can tell. So that's saying a lot. Thank you, Robert. Thanks very much
Thanks
for
again.
Being with us. Our guest this hour, Robert Bryce, and his book has just been published. He's been, somebody made reference, he was on Point this morning as they were talking about yesterday's EPA announcement. Robert is the author of his latest book, what we were talking about, Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper, How Innovation Keeps Proving the Catastrophists Wrong. He is a senior fellow. He's with the Center for Energy Policy and the Environment at the Manhattan Institute, and author of a number of other books as well. He's been writing for a number of publications, Wall Street Journal, The Nation, The Atlantic Monthly, The Washington Post, among others. Thanks to Marika Suval for producing this hour, and thanks to Marika Suval for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up momentarily. Hope you'll join us tomorrow for our program. We're going to be looking at skin cancer prevention one of the hours tomorrow. The numbers have gone up, and so what do you do to prevent this? We'll have some doctors from Frederick Hospital, which is here in the Milwaukee area. And tomorrow we'll also look at gun violence as a health epidemic. So join us for those conversations tomorrow from 1 to 3.